ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So far, none of the scientists who work on it have spoken publicly. And that is until now.
A scientific report used to justify the extension of one of the country's largest gas projects has been a really hotly contested piece of research. We've got state and federal politicians talking about it, scientists coming out against it, even anonymously. But while everyone has had their say, we haven't yet heard from the lead researcher behind it. From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on the Breakfast Wrap podcast, the lead researcher of the Murujuqa Rock Art Monitoring Program speaks out exclusively to Sally Sara. Also on the podcast today, we're going to turn back to Tasmania as concerns grow for the future of the state's new AFL team. And we'll hear from Māori politicians suspended over this famous parliamentary protest. All of that is coming up on the Breakfast Wrap podcast. But first, the federal government's provisional approval of Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas project. It prompted concerns over the future of rock art in Murujuqa near Karratha. Leading up to the decision, a number of scientists had been monitoring the site. They were measuring pollution to determine if the ancient rock paintings were at risk of damage. The state's premier, Roger Cook, pointed to their work to bat away criticism and argue for the project's extension to 2070.
If some scientists want to go on a political frolic as part of that process, we have to strip away the background noise and rely upon the reports to make good decisions on behalf of the people of Western Australia.
That's WA Premier Roger Cook speaking to us last week. It's been a fortnight since that crucial report was released, and as you heard Sally say, so far, none of the scientists who'd worked on it have spoken out publicly. That is until this morning. Ben Mullins is a professor at Curtin University's Faculty of Health Science. He's the lead scientist on the Murujuqa Rock Art Monitoring Project. He spoke exclusively to Sally this morning.
Ben, your report has been informing the Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt's decision on this project. And I just want to clarify on this. Ultimately, What was the conclusion that was reached in this report about the impact of industrial activity on this rock art?
So it's important to note that this is the largest project's ever been done anywhere in the world on this, and we've delivered the year two report of what is a five-year process and then ongoing monitoring after that with the Murujuqa Aboriginal Corporation. So our findings to date are that it appears there may have been some impact to the rocks, specifically one of the kinds of rocks, the granophyre. But the evidence is that given the air quality there at the moment is very good, much better than any Australian city, it's probably, and there's a lot of evidence that it was a lot higher in the past, in 2014, and then again higher again in the 70s and 80s, when there were really no restraint or no emissions regulations. So the evidence are that the effects that we have measured, this increased porosity in some of the rocks, most likely happened in the past. But obviously we're going to be looking into that to confirm those findings in the year three and four reports.
So, Ben, from the monitoring and work you've done so far, would you say that the rock art is at serious risk currently?
I think that from what we've seen, there's nothing in our report that suggests that industry and the rock art can't coexist and the emissions can't be managed to an appropriate level. So, obviously, given the recent government approvals, that's the way forward, especially if we want to get the World Heritage listing for Murujuqa over the line, because it's really an amazing place and it really deserves World Heritage protection.
There are a number of industrial sites in this area. How would you describe the impact that they're having on Murujuqa?
I think there's obviously lots of stuff that's been in the media about the how many tonnes of various kinds of emissions that have been thrown out there, but the key thing is that as I said before, the air quality there is very good. So the NO2, nitrogen dioxide, which is the main thing that's been talked about, the levels that we've been measuring over the last couple of years are about 10% to 50% of what you get in Sydney or Melbourne. So there, it's actually, despite the what sounds like a big emission on paper from the industries, the air is pretty clean. The highest air pollutant there is dust, and a lot of that's natural dust from the environment there. But obviously, some of that is from iron ore activities. But overall, that you know, the fact that the air is much cleaner now than it used to be leads us to believe, while we can't completely rule out any impact, it leads us to believe it's most likely something that is historic rather than current.
Ben, some might be surprised to hear your description of the report. We've heard from one expert outside of your research group who's accused the WA government of misrepresenting the findings in a summary report. The man making that case is Professor Benjamin Smith from the University of WA. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
The executive summary is clearly written by the West Australian government. It contradicts directly the findings inside the report.
What's your response to that?
Look, a lot's been made about this. The executive summary was always intended to be a simple lay person summary for the general public. It went through a process to develop it. I don't think it misrepresents the findings in the main report. And the important thing is that the full report, all 800 plus pages plus the associated documents, they have all been published exactly as we, the scientists, wrote them. We all stand by them, and the government's published them. They've also got a cast of international experts to peer review that document and the associated documents, and that's all been published as well. So really, the science should stand on its own. It's been out there. Unfortunately, it's 800 pages of really world-leading, world-first science, and it's hard for lay people to understand it. So unfortunately, it's been misrepresented by people that might have, specific agendas one way or the other.
One researcher on the project spoke anonymously to 7:30. They disagreed with Premier Cook. The Premier says the research shows there's no ongoing impact from industrial activity. Is the Premier right?
Look, you're talking about Professor Adrian Baddeley. He's our lead statistician on the project. He is one of the world's best statisticians, and that's a really important part of the project, that it's rigorously statistically designed.
And just to be clear, that was an anonymous quote, to be clear.
There's been an email leaked from that Adrian wrote, so that's what I'm referring to. I don't know who have spoken to you, but the important thing is, that demonstrates that there's robust and rigorous scientific debate, and the report is the true representation of what we've found.
And Ben, given that you're speaking to me today on breakfast, I just want to clarify: have you or any of your team been gagged at all during this entire process?
No, certainly not. We've, this is, as I said, a very large project. There's 55 scientists, the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, the government. So there's obviously a lot of wheels to this, and a lot of individual expert scientists are only expert in a specific field, and so don't necessarily see how all the pieces fit together. So we had a strategy for communications and media, and we did a lot of pre-records in our own words of the findings. It seems the media didn't really pick them up. And we'd hope the science would stand on its own. But I think given the importance of getting the World Heritage over the line, we really wanted to make it clear what the findings are, and the fact that there's nothing in our report that says that the rock art and the industry can't coexist and the emissions can't be managed appropriately. Obviously the way forward now, given the approvals.
But Ben, just finally, while this has been playing out, UNESCO has been considering giving Murujuga World Heritage listing, as you were referring to. The WA government thinks there can be an industrial development while also securing World Heritage listing. Do you believe that the two can coexist?
Well, As I said, there's nothing in our report that says it's not possible to manage emissions. They've obviously reduced a lot in the recent years, and I'm sure there are mechanisms that they can be reduced if needed. We've certainly had recommendations on appropriate limits in a supplementary report, and that will be monitored to ensure the rock art is protected. So I don't have any doubt that the rock art can be protected, and hopefully the UNESCO will see that and will inscribe Murujuga in the middle of the year.
Ben Mullins, the lead scientist on the Murujuga Rock Art Monitoring Program. There's going to be more to say on this story, so make sure you're following the Breakfast Wrap podcast, and you can listen back to that interview that you would have heard a snippet of with Roger Cook. It is also on the ABC Listen app. The dreams of thousands of Tasmanian footy fans are hanging in the balance this morning as the political chaos in the state threatens to derail the country's newest AFL club. The Tasmania Devils have become a political football. After the Parliament passed a vote of no confidence in Premier Jeremy Rockliffe, the team had entered the league hinged on providing this new roofed stadium. It was to be built as a key condition of the government's deal with the league. But approval for the new stadium now faces uncertainty. On the podcast today, you're going to hear two different perspectives on what has become an incredibly controversial debate in Tasmania. First up is Scott Wade. He's a former player and a former CEO of AFL Tasmania.
Are you even surprised how entangled this debate has become in state politics in Tasmania?
Oh, I'd be like most Tasmanians. I think we're all a bit confused as to what's gone on this week. So, it's very uncertain times for footy fans in Tassie, yeah.
Why do you think it's so important for this team to go ahead in Tasmania, and why are you in favour of the state spending this money on the stadium?
Oh, well, Tasmania desperately wants its own AFL team. We've got 200,000 plus foundation members, so we love our AFL footy. We've been fighting for our own AFL team for, you know, 4 or 5 decades almost. So it's been such a long time and such a long fight, and we were granted a licence conditional on a stadium, and I guess all the footy fans are you're really supportive of it. Just, yeah, let's get on with it. But I do understand that clearly Tasmanians are worried about the state of our budget. We're worried about whether we can afford a stadium. So I think it's reasonable for Tasmanians to ask the question, can we afford it? But, from a footy fan perspective, which is what I am, we're, you know, very supportive of the team and very supportive of the stadium. And we know it's a lot of money, but infrastructure for 50 to 100 years. And so in the general scheme of things, it's not that much money.
What do you think about a plan B, using one of the existing grounds or a couple of the grounds in Tasmania rather than spending all this money on a new stadium with a roof in Hobart?
Look, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what I say or what any other Tasmanian says. Doesn't even matter what the Premier says, to be quite honest. At the end of the day, a condition of the licence is a roof stadium at Macquarie Point, and so that's where it sits at the moment. I must say, I guess Tasmania's been asked to jump hurdles that perhaps none of the existing AFL clubs have ever been asked to jump. And that does seem a little unfair and unreasonable, and maybe it's time for the powers to be, the government of the day and the AFL, to try and get together and see if there is a plan B. But right at the moment, there is no plan B. And so I guess the uncertainty for footy fans is we just want our team, and we certainly are supportive of the stadium. I'm certainly supportive of a stadium close to Hobart City. I think, you know, the stadiums in Perth and Adelaide and obviously MCG and SCG are really close to the hearts of their cities, and I see no reason why Tasmania wouldn't benefit from the same economic benefits that those states get from their stadiums.
Was it unwise for Tasmania to sign this deal, given that the demand of this station, of this stadium, the condition of the stadium?
Look, I can't really comment. I don't think it was unwise at the time. I guess the Liberal Party, who were in power, or were still in power, I think, aren't they?
You tell me.
I have no idea. But yeah, the Liberal Party at the time chose to go down that path. Look, the Macquarie Point site is I think it'd be a perfect site for a stadium, so close to the city. It'd be an ideal site. So from a logical perspective, but Tasmanians are worried about the state of our budget. There's no question about that.
Scott Wade, former player and former CEO of AFL Tasmania. So as footy mad as Tasmania is, this plan for a stadium has angered some. And it's been specifically cited as a reason by some of those non-Labor MPs that voted for the no-confidence motion. One of them is Meg Webb, independent state member for Nelson.
Why do you think that this is not a good idea to push ahead with this stadium in Hobart?
Well, we've already seen a situation where we're going to breach the agreement reached and the contract signed because the stadium had to pass our planning system by 30 June. Now that Parliament has been disrupted, that's not going to be possible. And I think I'm going to agree with a lot of what Scott said to you just this morning. There's so many thousands of Tasmanians who are so keen to see our team in place and are delighted that we're taking steps towards that. And they're going to be incredibly disappointed if the AFL choose to rip that team away from us on the basis of this particular aspect of the contract not being able to be delivered in the way that they'd originally demanded. That would be very unreasonable. I agree with Scott that renegotiation and a reimagining of how we approach the stadium issue is absolutely what's needed, and it would be reasonable, and I think expected and compassionate for the AFL to be prepared to negotiate with our state on that.
This has all been playing out in the headlines and coming to a bit of a head in the past couple of days. But in some ways, is this whole debate not really about football at all? Because we've been hearing about the backdrop, the context in Tasmania, about concerns about the budget, concerns about the health system, things like literacy levels in Tasmania as well. Has this really just become a symbol of some of the bigger problems at the moment in the state?
I think many Tasmanians see this as absolutely illustrative of a government that is not prioritising things properly for our state, and a government that has taken actions without properly consulting with the community. We're talking about the deal that was signed a few years back now. Now, that deal was signed by the Premier behind closed doors with no consultation, even with his cabinet, let alone on Treasury advice, let alone talking to the Parliament or the Tasmanian people. And we signed us up to a team, yes, great, but it signed us up to this particular stadium that was demanded by the AFL at this particular location on a particular timeline that was always going to be problematic to deliver, because we needed to have a conversation as a community about whether that's what we wanted in terms of a stadium and its location and its design. So what we've seen now is a real mess. We've seen people concerned about this stadium, yes, on the basis of cost. You know, it's already gone up dramatically in what it's expected to cost. And even now we're not at the top of where that's going to land. It's going to be at well over $1 billion for this stadium. We've also seen huge concerns about the site. Now, I know Scott has said that it's a great site. Quite frankly, it's a terrible site for a stadium. It's a constrained site. There were significant plans in place and a master plan for developing that site for community use before the stadium came along. People were very invested in that and included a really important Aboriginal cultural park that was going to be there, which has now been displaced. It's right next to our incredibly beautiful maritime heritage area of our city. So there's lots of concerns about that site. Tasmanians are absolutely up for a conversation about where we could put a stadium that would work for the team and would work for our capital city, but we didn't get a chance to have that conversation. We just got a stadium demanded by the AFL and signed off behind closed doors by our Premier.
And that is Meg Webb, the independent state member for Nelson. If you want to hear more background to this whole story and how the politics of this has been playing out, check out the Breakfast Wrap podcast episode from Wednesday. It was right as the no-confidence motion was beginning to be debated in Tasmanian Parliament. All right, close your eyes for a moment. I want to take you back to New Zealand Parliament last year. So why are you listening to that now? Well, three members of New Zealand's Māori Party have now been suspended from Parliament following that haka protest during a parliamentary session in November. Te Pāti Māori co-leaders Debbie Narewa Parker and Nawiri Waititi will be suspended for 21 days, and MP Hana Rafiti Maipi Clark suspended for 7 days, taking effect immediately. Their suspensions are unprecedented in New Zealand politics. Before this, the longest ban for any New Zealand lawmaker lasted just 3 days. Debbie Narewa Parker is the co-leader of Te Pāti Māori and was suspended alongside her colleagues yesterday. She joined Sally this morning.
What's your reaction to this suspension from the Parliament?
I think a couple of things. I'm just hearing that haka. It sort of reminds me, you know, imagine having a government so threatened by Māori pride that suspended our youngest MP in Parliament instead of listening to her. But you know, what we're experiencing in New Zealand is probably not too different to a few other countries in the world at the moment. You know, we've got a coalition that includes, you know, well-known racists and bigots and, you know, ministers who mock our language, our culture, and have used their powers in the, you know, the Privileges Committee to to silence the voices of the Indigenous and the only Indigenous party. So, yeah, I think we've, you know, it's indicative of an extreme right-wing government that is shadowing a lot of behaviour of Trump.
As far as you understand, is this some of the harshest disciplinary penalties ever taken against New Zealand MPs in the House?
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I think that's why we've had this sort of bizarre process that went on for nearly 7 months and then a very long debate in the House yesterday. So we found the government, actually, in fact it was the Speaker of the House that requested that it be an open debate because he himself wasn't in favour of the length of time. But We've got a first-time coalition with many first-time ministers, and I think they've struggled to differentiate between their personal political view and the requirement for the Privileges Committee to remain neutral and to... I think that shows the extent of the ban. You know, 21 days is just shocking, which means around about, you know, 280,000 Māori are unrepresented for 21 days.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the practicalities of that. What does that mean? Because will all of your voices be absent then from key pieces of legislation and so on over the next few weeks?
Yeah, and I hate to say, I was trying to think, how can I speak objectively about something that we feel really subjective about? What it means is we've got some really revolting bill. So, you know, the Treaty Principles Bill was the starter. We've got another bill coming through called the Regulatory Standards Bill, which, you know, effectively is wiping the treaty out. And so we've got we've got that bill going through a process at the moment, so we're not allowed to attend select committees. We're not allowed to put in written questions and oral questions, obviously. We're not allowed to do official requests of any information of the ministers during this time. And obviously we're not allowed to be in the House to debate. And our voting capacity is halved because we're only a party of six. So, I think, you know, for doing the haka and not a single member of the committee could explain where the 21 days came from. We feel aggrieved in the fact that for doing our haka, that it has, you know, received such a harsh penalty. But also, I think, almost relieved that we've been able to show the world what this particular government's behaviour is and its overreach and its discomfort, not only with Māori, with women, with rainbow communities and with those communities that are struggling. It's just a moment in time of some revolting right-wing politics we're contending with in New Zealand that I don't think anyone ever expected to come out of this country. And we're part of the attack zone. So, yeah, there's a few consequences.
Would you perform the haka again in Parliament?
Oh, absolutely. And the haka has been performed before. And my co-leader at Awari has been on the floor 5 other times from his seat. So, you know, again, the punishment doesn't match the tikanga, or what they're calling our tikanga now, our Māori ways criminal. And it's not unprecedented. We've done the haka before, we've done the karanga, we've done songs before. It's just that this government has decided that we're in the way of a bigger agenda, which is to, if you remove Indigenous rights, you remove the Treaty of Waitangi, then it's easier to bring in corporate exploitation. And we're very mindful of what it is that we're living. And we say that in all our speeches. We've got a huge social media following, and we're the only party that has continued to poll strong. So, there's a bigger agenda here. You make Indigenous peoples look criminal and scary, and they're going to do some horrific things, extremist. It matches the agenda of trying to grow your own political profile. So, and we see it for what it is. And I think we're up for it. I'm from Parihaka in Taranaki. We've been through worse. And we just have to stay strong and stay united and be up for the long game.
Debbie Narewa-Parker is the co-leader of the Te Pāti Māori Party and was suspended alongside her colleagues. And that is the Breakfast Wrap podcast for today and for this week. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the fantastic ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and the podcast was produced by the equally fantastic Louise Myland and Kathy Niven. Our executive producer is Eleni Saltis. I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon. Take care. We'll see you next week.